Thank you for having me, Jessup. Thank you, Dr. Jackson, wherever you are. There you are. It's a pleasure to. It's really bright up here. I want to. Let's see if the slides are working here. Yeah, there we go. That's my contact information, my email, my cell phone. And if that's too ambitious as a first contact, all my introverts here, raise your hand. They never raise their hand. It's all my introverts. There's the website, so you can learn more and come at your own speed, you know. But I want to be helpful for you because we have a very short time on this earth together, and it's just such a blessing to occupy some of the same space as all of you. So I gave this talk a fun title here. I was really thinking. I just took a think week in the wilderness. Anyone heard of Clipper Mills, California? Gold country? One woo? Okay. From Clipper Mills? Okay. Yeah, so I've been in Clipper Mills just thinking about the greatest commandment. And, you know, I'm one guy. Here's a field guide to the greatest commandment of loving God with all our heart and loving our neighbors as ourselves. And just a few reflections that I've had on this commandment in doing this work and sharing a little bit more about this work in the process. Let's see if this slide is going to work. Okay, a little tech. Oh, there we go. So we know what that greatest commandment is: love your neighbor, love yourself, love your neighbor as yourself, love God. And there's a few questions that have come up for me as I think about this commandment. So loving your neighbor, who's Jesus? How would Jesus love his neighbor? Loving myself, who am I? What kind of, am I worthy of love? And then how to love God, just this question of who we are as a people, as children of God. So that's really, you know, the questions I want to start with, beginning with loving your neighbor. So I think I need a hammer to, like, slam this thing. So this is the church that I attended in San Francisco. And they had a project six years ago, called Who is Jesus? And you were invited to answer this question with an art form. So I was thinking, well, there's a lot of people that are talented musicians, but I don't know if Jesus needs a song from me. And I don't know if you want to hear a song from me. I'm not a great singer. Great singing, the band. It was terrific. But maybe Jesus needs artwork, right? Who is Jesus? Let's express this in art. But I'm not much of an artist. So I just started thinking and praying about this. Like, how can I answer this question of who is Jesus with who I am and how God made me? And I started thinking about that. And, you know, I think about my love of technology, my love of storytelling. And I also was thinking about my family. And this is a photo of my family. That's me at the bottom right there. I still make that pose, kind of do the little wrist thing. It's my mom, my brother, my grandpa, grandma. And in the middle there, that's my uncle Mark. And Mark was my favorite member of my extended family. He remembered every birthday, guest of honor at Thanksgiving and Christmas. He also suffered from schizophrenia. And he lived on and off the streets for 30 years. But just like any members of your family, you don't look at someone as defined by their problem. You look at them as a beloved family member. So that's how I saw Mark, and it wasn't until he died that I was sitting there at his gravesite talking with my dad about the brother that he lost who spent 30 years of his life on the streets. And I just started thinking at this gravesite, you know, as beautiful as this is as a commemorative way for Mark to be remembered, this gravesite doesn't tell me anything else about this man. It doesn't tell me about the life he lived, how he remembered every birthday, how he loved super burritos, just loved them. All the good years are in the dash. It's like the great comma, right? Jesus' entire life just summarized by a comma. He came and he died and he rose again. What about the life? What about the way, what he taught me? And so I got this question on my heart connected to this, you know, who is Jesus, that really has shaped my journey ever since, which was, how would Jesus use a smartphone? We use a smartphone, right? And when I think about the technology we use, or, you know, social media, how would Jesus use social media? How would Jesus use, you know, a GoPro camera? And I started thinking about it. I thought, well, you know, we walk by people And their stories aren't being told. And yet we have the greatest storytelling tool that we have ever invented in our pockets. And when we see a person like this, we just see garbage. We see a problem. We don't see someone's aunt or uncle or brother or sister or mother or father. And so I thought about the GoPro camera. And I said, okay, you know, this is how we use GoPro cameras, right? You get on a surfboard, you're so cool, post it on Instagram or Snapchat or whatever y'all use. And then if we're really innovative with something like this, it's like, okay, right? Like, this is our creative potential as humans, right? And so I just got this question on my heart, like, well, what if Jesus was here using a GoPro camera, what would he do? And, you know, this was the response here. There we go. Over a course of a year, had 24 individuals experiencing homelessness volunteer to wear GoPro cameras and narrate their experiences of what life is like. If I was here as a student, you know, or at least if this is like a church service here, I'm sitting often in the back row. I have such a heart for people on the periphery. I want to know the person who came in late, leaves early, and no one talked to. That's where my heart is. People with ravens in their hands in the front row, God bless them. I'm on the periphery. I'm on the margins. And so I went to the margins, and I said, well, here's this camera. I don't know anything about you. Would you want to share your story? 24 individuals wore these cameras over the course of the year. Here's just a little video clip of one of those individuals.
I'm living in San Francisco. I've been homeless on and off for like almost 6 years now. Most people that are homeless, I hear it from friends and I see it, don't have any type of real interaction that means anything to them when you're homeless, because people treat you so much different.
About 90% of these people could care less while I'm standing in front of them or not, you know? And most of them would not want to see me yet, would rather not see me at all out here. And when I say that, I don't mean see me out here being homeless, they would just rather not see me out here at all. You know, and it's, I guess, the way that our side is turned, where they look at me like I'm below them or something like that, and they don't realize it. Like I said earlier, that, you know, a lot of people that I know right here in this neighborhood, in Castro, are living paycheck to paycheck, wondering if they're going to be housed next week. How you doing, folks? Tomorrow's my birthday. I'm trying to get a hotel. I'll go and get a paper. See what I mean?
So I get footage like that over and over again, and, you know, my heart's broken. Repeatedly just broken open. And as I listen a little closer, I hear a common theme, and it was really captured by this quote. I never realized I was homeless when I lost my housing, only when I lost my family and friends. Wow. And I hear that, and I thought, that I've never heard any service provider mention this. I've never heard any, you know, program talk about this, but this makes sense. This is intuitive. Theoretically, if that's true, I can just walk down Market Street in downtown San Francisco, go up to every person I see who's experiencing homelessness, and ask simply, hey, do you have any family or friends you'd like to reconnect with? And maybe some of them will say yes. So that's what I did. 5 years ago at Christmas time, walked down Market Street, met a man named Jeffrey. I walked by him the first time. I'm not going to paint myself into this, like, angel saint anything. I walked by him. He had a bottle of, alcohol at his side. He was talking to himself. I sat down next to him, came back. God called me and said you were going to talk to everyone. You just walked by this guy. Went back, sat down next to him. Hey, I'm Kevin. Nice to meet you, you know? And he's, like, swearing at me. Vile stuff, right? And I almost just got up and left. I said, this is the last guy who's going to need to reconnect or whatever. But I ended up saying, hey, do you have any family or friends you'd like to reconnect with? And for the first time in the entire interaction, he looked me right in the eye. He said, I haven't seen my family in a long time. My niece, Rachel, my nephew, my sister, Jennifer, my dad, Harold, I'd love to reconnect with them. And I said, okay. Do you want to record a video? He said, yeah, I do. This is the video that Jeffrey recorded. Okay, I'm just like really trying to get this thing. Okay.
My name is Jeffrey Michael Gottschall. I was born August 7th, 1969. in a small town in Pennsylvania named Torchville.
Are there any friends that you would like to send a holiday message?
In Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania?
Torchville, Pennsylvania, if you can.
Well, like what are their names?
My dad, Harold.
What would you like to say to your dad?
I intend to go home and see you again someday.
So I get this message on my smartphone. What do you do with it? What would you do with this message? Raise your hand. What would you do? What did I do? Take a guess. Okay. Post it, someone said. Absolutely nothing. I didn't believe him. I sat on that message for a week because I thought I was just going to cause problems. I'm ashamed of it still. But after a week, it's Christmas Eve, I got this video on my smartphone. I said, I got to do something with this thing. So I go on Facebook, and I found a Facebook group connected to his hometown. Within 1 hour, that video was shared over 100 times. It made the local news that night. Classmates started commenting, I went to high school with Jeffrey. I work in construction. Does he need a job? I work at the congressman's office. Does he need health care? $5,000 was raised in a 24-hour period to try to bring him home. And in the first 20 minutes of the post, his sister got tagged.
I've been talking to many people, trying to do what I can to get you home and the help that you need once you're here. My holiday message to you is this. If you don't give up, I won't either.
And she told me that Jeffrey had been a missing person for 12 years. Broad daylight, downtown San Francisco, a week before Christmas. So shortly after that, she took a train across the country, 4-day trip. They got reconnected in person for the first time in 22 years. Wow, thank you. Now, did that suddenly solve all of Jeffrey's problems? No. He had underlying addictions. He suffered from schizophrenia. In fact, he was one of the people in the last 5 years that was the hardest to reach. So even though his homelessness wasn't immediately ameliorated, and he resisted the services that really were required to take those next steps, there was an opening. There was a sense of possibility where one didn't exist before. The police had someone to call when he got picked up. His family, he knew he was a lifeline, and he had the chance to make that choice if he wanted to. And I knew that Jeffrey wasn't the only one, and that this shouldn't be happening. So at that point, I quit my job, much to my dad's chagrin, and I said, I gotta do this full time. And then what happened is I said, actually, God, you got the wrong guy. I can't do this. I have no business doing this work. I don't know that much about homelessness. Homelessness isn't my issue. I care more about education, the environment, social justice. Homelessness, it's my local backyard thing. I want to go elsewhere. For 2 or 3 months, I just had that on my heart, and I said, I can't do anything about this. But I made a deal with God. Anyone here make deals with God? You do? At least one of you? So I made a deal with God. I said, I'm going to go to the shelter, God. I'm going to announce that, hey, Kevin, I'm reconnecting people with loved ones. Miracle messages is what we're calling it. If you want to reconnect to someone, come see me. Otherwise, have a good day. I did that. Go to the St. Anthony's, make the announcement, and to my total relief, no one raises their hand. And I'm just like skipping out. I'm like, yeah, you know, this is my skip. And I get to the outside, and then this guy comes up to me, and he's just like, hi, I heard you make an announcement. My name's Johnny. I haven't seen my family in 33 years. I was like, okay, sure, let's record a message, Johnny. And he gets reconnected. 3 weeks later, his brother sisters get tagged in a post. They fly across the country on their own dime. They're in a hotel room looking at me and saying, thank you for giving me my family back. And so, all right, God. got it, okay. So at that point, I said, okay, I gotta look into this more. I got to really understand what's going on. You know, sociologist, I want to understand the dynamics. And this is what I found. Why are people disconnected? Right? If they want to reconnect to their family, why don't just reach out to them? What's the problem? There's really a few reasons. There's technological barriers, right? Losing a phone number, not having access to the internet, huge issue. And then we also have bureaucratic barriers, So HIPAA, Health Information Privacy Act, you can't reveal whether someone's there. So you end up with missing person flyers at shelters saying, have you seen my son? Have you seen my daughter? The shelters can't confirm or deny whether someone's there, right? So it's just like a black hole of information. There's reasons to protect privacy. You don't want to have that public, but there's also, there's a loophole in that. And then you get into the economic barriers. You know, we're living at a moment where one out of every two Americans are a paycheck away from not being able to pay rent. 47% of people in this country self-report not knowing where they get $400 for an unexpected emergency. There's not much wiggle room in those situations. So you end up with entire families and social systems that normally would provide the support, but just don't have the resources to do it. But really, the biggest reason of all, I want you to listen to this video and then you tell me what that reason is. This is Ben.
I came here and I knew that maybe somebody like you guys could maybe help me out a little bit, because I'm an alcoholic and I got a problem and I don't know how to fix it. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do anymore. Hmm. And I haven't talked to my family in forever. And I'm just worried that they hate me. And I really miss my sister Catherine a lot, because she's my sister. And I really miss my brother Rusty. And I miss my brother Gary, and I miss my dad a lot. Hmm. And haven't been very good to him. But it's not because that I don't care about them. It's that I don't really care about myself a lot. And that's why I've been away for a long time. And I just want to tell you, I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry. I miss you guys, and I wish I could figure out some way to reconnect with you guys. Okay, I guess that's all I gotta say.
Okay. I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. Or shame, fear, embarrassment, pride. You know, I always wonder in the garden if God came back into the garden and we were standing there, Adam and Eve, with the apple core just rolling around and just said, we've done this horrible thing. If that wouldn't have led to forgiveness, and if what really was the fall was the hiding that happened after the sin. The separation. Because that's what I've seen on the streets. People embarrassed, afraid, ashamed of what they've done, what they haven't done, and then they say, I'm not worthy. And that's what our society reinforces, the stigma. And so the number one reason, if you guessed it, is the emotional barrier: shame, embarrassment, fear, isolation, self-loathing. And so I really just, have wondered through this work, if really we're punished by our sins rather than for our sins. So what we're talking about here is a type of poverty that often doesn't get addressed. It's a relational poverty. And relational poverty is a form of poverty. Social capital, if there's any aspiring sociologists in the room that want to study this topic. Can someone go back to, there we go. And I thought, what's a way to get past this relational poverty that's on the streets is to get down to people's level. I'm just going to dramatically step down. There, yeah. stoop down, right? God stoops a little more elegantly than Kevin. All right, keep going. When I raise my hand, just go to the next slide. That's going to be the new thing. So a little bit now how to love yourself. I'm going to talk about two aspects of that, the work self, professional self, and then learning to love the personal self. So the work self, Miracle Messages is a nonprofit reunion service. We help people experiencing homelessness reconnect with their loved ones. We're on a mission to end relational poverty on the streets. Here's how it works. We record messages, we deliver messages, we reunite family and friends. Sometimes family is part of the problem, not part of the solution. I want to just pause on that for a second. Domestic violence, cases of LGBTQ youth getting kicked out of households. Let's not gloss over why sometimes family isn't providing the support. But what we say is everyone is someone somebody. And whether it's brother, sister, mom, dad, son, or daughter, or it's your best friend, your coach, your classmate, your neighbor, who's your somebody that you want to reconnect with? What we do is we record messages. We have a hotline, 1-800-MISS-YOU, M-I-S-S-Y-O-U. You call that number, a person on the streets calls that number, it reaches one of our volunteer operators standing by that then routes the call, starts taking down some information to try to find the loved ones. We also have a mobile app on iOS. You can download Miracle Messages. We have a paper form and an online form. It's not just me running around. Sometimes video can be exploitative, voyeuristic. So what we do is we use written forms, paper forms, audio messages, whatever it takes. Then we've built a network of volunteer digital detectives, people who want to use social media for social good. All of you could be digital detectives if you're interested. Every Wednesday at 5:30 p.m., we have our nationwide conference call for our network of digital detectives to try to find the families and friends and help folks reunite. These are the numbers to date. Look at that bottom one. That's very important. 15 years is the average time disconnected. Can you imagine? Just let's close our eyes for a second in the rush before class and everything else. Close your eyes. Can you imagine going 15 years, let alone 15 days, without talking to your mom or your brother or your best friend? I mean, I can't. I want to open my eyes immediately with that thought. 80% of the messages are positively delivered. 80% of the time, the family is excited to reconnect. And 15% of the time, it leads to stable housing or living with family right away. Which is so exciting. Okay, that's our mobile app, our form, our hotline card. And then we have an initiative called Find Them, where families have started reaching out looking for their homeless relatives. 400 messages and counting saying, hey, I want to find my brother or sister, my son or daughter, they're missing in your city. We started doing reunites. So now let's talk about the personal side. So that's the kind of loving self, that's the work, that's what Miracle Message is about. So on the personal side, neuroscientists at Princeton and Duke have found that the part of the brain that activates when we see a person compared to an inanimate object is called the medial prefrontal cortex. Okay, stay with me. And that part of the brain has been found not to respond when we see someone who we perceive to be in an extreme outgroup in our society. And that's been found to be the case with the homeless, meaning we literally don't register them neurologically the same as we would with someone we don't perceive as homeless. What does that mean in practice? In an experiment from the New York City Rescue Mission, we'll go back a slide, actually. That was just a point. That was more of an emphatic thing. Yeah. Members of a person's very own family were dressed up to look homeless. And not a single person recognized, in this case, her own mom and dad. Not a single person recognized their own family member dressed homeless out of 100 iterations of this experiment. So then it gets this question of who are we? Who am I? What is going on that makes that possible? Well, I know I'm a person who's experienced a lot of joy in life, but also I've had my share of traumas, probably just like you. Here's a photo of the street that I grew up on, that the house was burned in the Tubbs fire just a few years ago. There's been divorces, there's been separations, there's been deaths. So when I think about myself and I think about why am I disconnected from a person, I'm usually just in my own head. I'm just dealing with my own stuff. And it's not to underestimate those traumas, but what I found is that if we touch in with our suffering, we actually have more in common with the person on the streets than we realize. Because those individuals have experienced traumas too. Maybe they were displaced as a result of a fire or flood. And you get these signs as a result where you see, you know, just a horrible, heartbreaking, at least give me the finger. Can you imagine being on the streets, writing a sign, just so deprived of human contact that you just want someone to just acknowledge you, even if it's with their middle finger? Right? And I think about, well, I'm stooping down to this person, but maybe this person is stooping down to me. Maybe they're ministering to me as much as I'm ministering to them. I've certainly heard the words, bless you, God bless you, more to me than I've said to people in this work. So, you know, when I was 12, I felt like something was missing in my life besides puberty, which was also missing. It has since arrived. Shaved this morning. No, I didn't. When I was 12, I asked my family if we could start going to local churches. I wasn't raised religious. Through that process, we all got baptized. My mom, my dad, my brother, and I, because I felt the unconditional love of my parents before I even knew the name of God, and that's what brought me to Jesus, you know? And this is my family, and it looks so happy and go lucky, you know, but there's real traumas there. That's my parents, you know, on the wedding day, super cute, right? But my dad, he grew up in a broken home. He escaped the war at home to go to the war in Vietnam. That's him in Vietnam, right? And worked for years at gas stations after Vietnam and finally had a teacher who saw his potential in the math and sciences, went to Berkeley, then MIT, became a top scientist in his field. My dad and I never quite see eye to eye, right? There's the traumas there. So I'm thinking about these things. With my mom, I'm just pointing, I'm not even using the clicker anymore. You know, my mom was my rock, was just the foundation, the most loving, strong, warm, kind person I ever met. She passes away when she's 59 and I'm 23 from breast cancer. And suddenly I'm just feeling so alone in the world, and all these people that had loved me are feeling more and more distant from, how do I love myself? And I feel like I'm in the wilderness phase, you know? And I spent many years not knowing what it felt like to be healthy as an adult. How do you take care of yourself when no one is taking care of you? The world isn't so nurturing and loving, I found, and that was hard. And so I practiced, I was in Israel and practiced this ancient Jewish spiritual practice called Hitbadadut. And it's this extemporaneous speaking aloud to God, just seeing what comes up, just talking. And I did this, and I was shocked by what I was saying. Incredible expressions of inadequacy, self-loathing, feeling like I wasn't good enough, I wasn't prepared, I'm not worthy. So that led over the last year to get what I call a PhD in myself. Learn to be your own best friend, the school of life, PhD, put it on LinkedIn, you're ready. And that led to all sorts of things of, you know, learning to disentangle growth mindset from inner critic. What does that mean? Inner critic, growth mindset, two separate things. Not being your first casualty of your work. And realizing from 1 Corinthians 12:7 that each of us is given this spiritual gift for the common good. What does it mean to see our spiritual gift and love it? And really, I think about the words of Rabbi Hillel the elder. If I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? And I think again about that greatest commandment. Well, that kind of lines up, love yourself, right? This gets to the idea, spend time together if you love yourself. Listen to the self-talk, reflect on the values. If you love your neighbor, you stoop down, you follow Jesus. You don't judge your neighbor necessarily. But where does that leave loving God? As I start concluding here, loving God, how do we love God? Here's the answer, I don't know. I don't know what that means. But let me tell you a little bit about what I've learned from trying to love God over the last 35 years. Here's what I've learned. I've learned that there's a relationship between all of these, the self, the neighbor, and the God. This is why it's part of the greatest commandment. That there's no deep knowing of God without a deep knowing of self. And there's no deep knowing of self without a deep knowing of God, said John Calvin. Rachel Held Evans, it's not just that Jesus is like God. Maybe God is like Jesus. That if we have no peace, it is because we have forgotten that we belong to each other, says Mother Teresa. and that there's an idea of a dislocated exegesis, that we could read the Bible in places like prisons or places like on the streets, not necessarily ministering to others, but ministering to ourselves. How do we read these sacred texts differently if we get ourselves outside of our comfort zone and read them where people are suffering? I think about people like Brian and Beverly, who are our first two formerly homeless community ambassadors. We've given them their first job since they've been on the streets. Both of them reconnected with their loved ones as a result. They're best friends. That's a little cute dog in the bottom there, if you see it. It's a really cute dog, super cute dog. And they have taught me so much more than I've taught them. They teach me how to be open with myself, how I can cry and emote. Beverly, every time she tells her story, she cries. I have so much admiration for her ability to have her heart broken again and again, so openly, so courageously. Think about people like Edwin, who reconnected to his family, told me when I met him, that's the night I'm going to die tonight. I'm not going to make it anymore. I said, no, you're not. He reconnected to his aunt. He's living with his family. People like Wayne and Jasmine. Wayne had been, her uncle, Jasmine, walked the streets of San Francisco every week looking for her uncle, never found him, and finally they got reconnected through Miracle Messages volunteers. Go to Corpus Christi for just a few days, make an announcement. All these people recorded messages. Just to highlight one in the middle, that's Jose Ruiz Zavala. He said he hadn't seen his family in 50 years. He was sold into slavery when he was 8 years old. Grew up in Zacatecas, Mexico, a farm, sold onto a farm, and as a result, he ends up recording a message, just wanting to reconnect. I thought, there's no way God's going to work in this relationship. This guy's in Corpus Christi, Texas. How's he going to find his family? How's he going to get reconnected to the loved ones? Posted on social media, within an hour or two, goes viral. A Univision reporter gets tagged in the post, drives 6 hours into the mountainside, finds Jose Ruiz Zavala's family. They were still on the farm, and that's a photo of the family there. We're working to get his paperwork so he can get reunited. Not all reunions have this beautiful happy ending. In Dale's case, got reconnected, moved back home, but his alcohol problems persisted. He had to get kicked out as a result, not a safe place for the niece to be there, and he ends up a month after reuniting being found deceased. And I think about him, and I feel like I failed him. But I know that this work persists because, as his sister said, you gave us a shot. You gave it a shot, and we had this chance to get to, my niece had a chance to get to know her uncle, and yet you tried. And I think about whether this work would have been appropriate for my own uncle, Mark. And it really depends on the day. Some days were good days, some days are bad days. But any day, I like to think we can live in a world where people like my Uncle Mark would know that a service like this exists. You know, and Mick reconnected to his mom after 67 years. That's a photo of him when he was a baby. 67 years! And she was 85, and she said, I'd love nothing more than to spend the last few years of my life getting to know my son, who she had to give up for adoption because he had a birth defect and she couldn't afford the procedure. And I think about, in a case like that, how a mother holds their child like my mom held me. And I think about who's looked at each of us with those tender eyes. Who have we looked at with such loving eyes? And maybe that's where we need to take it to the streets, is look at people like we've been looked at by the most loving person we know. You know, because I know an activist, which I see all of you as activists, refuse to take the world for granted. So the question then becomes, what can I do? For me and my life, and I'm not ministering to you, I'm ministering to myself, I've learned to show people that I'm Christian more than I'm telling them. And the world is very commonly telling people Christian. For me, I've shown people I'm Christian by how I try to live. I invite you to come and join us and show people your faith by getting involved. miraclemessages.org/get involved, starting a college chapter here at William Jessup University, being a digital detective, offering miracle messages locally. Also, second way you can help, remember, you are courageous. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God, trust also in me. Ask tough questions. Ask questions. What's your relationship to your neighbors? What's your relationship to technology? How are you showing up in the world in the ways that you connect? And finally, and most importantly, befriend. God works through relationships. This is my favorite word, perhaps. It's Greek. It's the opposite of xenophobia. This is the word that we bring over. This is what we all know, xenophobia. Philoxenia, it means love of stranger, friend to the stranger. What would it look like if we embark from this day forward and every stranger over spring break we encounter or even the rest of our lives, we practice philoxenia for them? And I'll tell you what it means for us. It means all these individuals, Jeffrey, Johnny, Mick, Perry, all get reconnected to their loved ones because we know that everyone is someone, somebody. God bless you. Thank you.